Well, welcome tonight to session 17 on the Gospel of Mark. Last time we were in Bethany and the institution of the Lord's Supper. Now, the timeline here is right around the Feast of Unleavened Bread and Passover, which is in the month of Nisan, and the Lord's Supper, where they were partaking of the Passover meal, according to Mark, was supposed to be done the 14th of Nisan. And so they partake of the meal, and then Jesus institutes the communion where he explains the bread and the wine and the symbolism behind his broken body and the blood for the new covenant. And then he tells his disciples that they will desert him, that he will be struck down and they will scatter. And then Peter just affirms that this is not the case. He says, even if I must die with you, I will never deny you. And the rest of his disciples also said the same thing. We're going to be looking here at the betrayal and trials of Jesus. We're going to be going to the Garden of Gethsemane, looking at when Jesus is betrayed and arrested, then his trial before the Sanhedrin, Peter denying Jesus, and then Jesus being brought before Pontius Pilate, and his torture by and mocking by the Roman soldiers. So we're going to begin in Mark chapter 14, verse 32. It says, and they went to a place that was named Gethsemane. Now, Gethsemane is a Hebrew Aramaic word that just means oil press. It's a Hebrew Aramaic words transliterated into Greek for oil press. And this is located on the eastern side of Jerusalem here between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives, which is kind of down here in the Kidron Valley. And Gethsemane was known to be this place where there was a grove of olive trees, hence why it was called Gethsemane, because of the olive trees where they would press the olives for oil. Now, we talked last time about the teaching that Jesus did on the Mount of Olives about some of the incoming struggles and suffering and things they would face and ultimately things that would happen at the end of the age, speaking eschatologically at the end times. And here on the Mount of Olives, as you transverse down, you'll see down here is the Kidron Valley that goes around the base here of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So they were up here and they then are traveling now down to the Garden of Gethsemane. So when they're in Gethsemane, he, Jesus, said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. So Jesus is going to be involved in a time of prayer. And he's asking his disciples, stay put. And he took Peter, James, and John with him. So the rest of the disciples stay. Jesus selects three disciples to go with him. And he began to be greatly distressed and troubled. This might be the first time in the Gospel of Mark we read about Jesus in these sort of terms, that he is greatly distressed and troubled. We'll soon come to understand why. So Jesus says to them, he said to Peter, James, and John, my soul is deeply grieved, almost to the point of death. Remain here and stay awake. And he, Jesus, he went a short distance away from them and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour would pass from him. He's praying to God, and he used this phrase, the hour would pass, would that he would not have to experience what was coming. The hour, which just refers to the time period, that it would pass, it would go over him, he would not go through it. And he said, Abba, which is means Father. So he says, Abba, Father, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. This cup means this enduring agony, this experience that he knows he's going to suffer and die. He's saying, take this away from me. Take this away from in front of me. I don't want to have to go through it. Nevertheless, Jesus says this. So Jesus doesn't want to. He doesn't want to go through with what he knows is required of the Messiah, from what he even foretold his disciples that he must die. He does not want to go through with it, but he says, it's not what I want, but what you want. Jesus here is showing his disciples, even though his disciples aren't there, but Mark is giving us this picture of Jesus for those who want to follow him, that he is showing the ultimate self-sacrifice, that he is giving up himself. He is losing his life here, both metaphorically, because he's denying his own desires, but literally he will be laying down his life on the cross. Verse 37, and he came, Jesus came and found them sleeping. He had just told them, stay awake. And he goes and prays and comes back and they're sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, which is Peter's name, Simon, are you sleeping? Were you not strong enough to stay awake for 1 hour? Stay awake and pray so that you do not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And again, Jesus, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. He goes and he reiterates his prayer. It was such an emotional time for Jesus that he had to go back and enter into prayer again a second time. And he came back again a second time and he found them again sleeping, because their eyes were heavy. And so he wakes them up and asks them, why are you sleeping? And it says, they did not know how to answer him, besides just saying, yeah, we were asleep, master. But they had no excuse. They were not able to stay awake as Jesus had asked of them. In verse 41, he came a third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hand of sinners. Get up, let's go. Look, the one who's betraying me has drawn near. This scene here in the Garden of Gethsemane portrays Jesus as having intense emotions by being deeply distressed and troubled. And his prayers reveal that he has internal conflict with what is going to be ensuing through his arrest, his torture, crucifixion, and death. He knows that this is what it means to fulfill the divine plan and purpose for him as the Messiah. But he wants to escape this imminent suffering and death. And the disciples here, in their triple failure to remain with Jesus in prayer, to remain awake, it shows the sense of human frailty and their spiritual unpreparedness for what is about to take place. Jesus knows what is coming, but his disciples don't seem to really get how serious it is. They don't know what is on the horizon just around the corner, as Judas, we will find out, is approaching. Now, in Mark's gospel, this shows that Jesus, even though he doesn't want to follow through with what he has to in his suffering and death as the Messiah, but he is resolved to follow God's plan despite knowing the physical and emotional agony that he will have to endure. And as he's going away to pray and then returning back to the disciples, and they're not with him in prayer, they decided to lay down and fall asleep. This is sort of foreshadowing the coming theme of abandonment that's going to be happening here before Jesus is arrested, and the literal abandonment will happen. And there are some failures here that can be paralleled with Israel's past and their failure to remain faithful during times of trial. And Jesus' disciples here are given multiple chances at staying awake and praying with Jesus, but each time they relapse and fail. All right, Jesus is betrayed and then arrested. Verse 43, and immediately, again, here as Mark's common motif, things happen rapidly. While he was still speaking about the one who's betraying is drawn near, basically that means has come, is there. While he's speaking these things, Judas, one of the 12, Mark makes sure people understand that this is one of Jesus's people. This is one of the 12 that he chose. He arrived, and with him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs who'd come from the chief priests and the experts in the law and the elders. Now the one who was betraying him had given them a signal. So he premeditated this, is what it's saying. Judas was told them, here is how you will know who Jesus is. Whomever I kiss is the one. Arrest him and lead him away under guard. And when he had arrived, he immediately went up to him and said, Rabbi, and kissed him. So Judas approaches, goes up, says Rabbi, which means teacher, and then gives him a kiss on the cheek. And then verse 46, they laid their hands on him and arrested him. But one of his followers, Mark doesn't name who this is, but one of his followers who was standing nearby drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus answered and said to them, have you come out with swords and clubs to capture me as if I were a criminal? I was with you daily teaching in the temple and you did not arrest me, but let the scriptures be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. Mark makes this comment about one of Jesus's followers decides to use physical violence to try to fight off this crowd who's come armed with clubs and swords and everything. So he tries to fight them off and cuts off the high priest servant's ear. But then Mark changes the focus. He moves to Jesus. And Jesus here sort of offers this ironic statement that this group of people have come with swords and clubs as though he was a criminal. He's sort of being, you know, ironic about, I am unarmed, I've done nothing wrong, and you act as though I'm a criminal. But he said, let the scriptures be fulfilled. And Jesus allowed himself to then be arrested. He did not put up any resistance. He knew that this was part of God's plan, and that if he was to do the Father's will, he had to go along with it. Verse 51, but a certain young man followed him who wore a linen garment wrapped around his naked body. And they tried to arrest him, but he left the linen garment and fled naked. This is an odd detail for Mark to include in his gospel, that there was one certain young man who followed Jesus after he got arrested. And all he had on his body was a linen garment, basically a sheet wrapped around him. I don't know why he's dressed this way, but he goes to become arrested almost, and they probably grab the sheet that's around him, and he lets go and then runs away, and he flees naked. The only thing that I think I can see in why this detail was important was that it might be somehow symbolic. Mark might be using this man and the way that he was wrapped with a garment and then abandoned it and left and fled naked somehow is symbolizing vulnerability and isolation. Otherwise, it's just an oddity that Mark would include this detail, because a lot of times when we tell narratives and we use details like this, we mean for it to be some type of maybe comic relief. But this is not a comical thing for Mark. He's not putting in some little joke here. But whatever the purpose is for this statement in verse 51 and 52, it is what wraps up the time in the garden with the betrayal of Judas and Jesus's arrest. Now, the people who come with swords and clubs to capture him, the kiss that Judas gives Jesus as the indication of who he is so that the people can arrest the right person is shown to be, I think, a stark contrast, that the kiss in the ancient culture, ancient Israelite in the Near East culture, was a sign of affection, a sign of deep friendship and trust. And for Judas to use that sign to indicate who Jesus was in his betrayal is just so polar opposite. It shows the extreme depth of Judas's betrayal of Jesus. And for these individuals to come out with these swords and clubs shows that they're actually intimidated or afraid of Jesus to some degree, that they have to bring weapons with them. And it shows kind of the absurdity of they don't even understand who Jesus is that he's not a physical threat. Because if they did, then they wouldn't need to bring those items with them. But they were thinking in terms of some type of rebel leader, someone who would be seditious or would try to cause an uprising. So for them, they brought out with their expectation enough enforcement to get the job done, even though it was completely uncalled for. And this sort of betrayal is the climactic fulfillment of Jesus' prediction about his betrayal and abandonment. And it's really the turning point now here where from this point on, Jesus is headed in only one direction, under the custody of these enemy forces, hostile forces, where he will be unfairly trialed, he will be beaten and tortured, and then crucified and killed. And so this sort of sets the stage for these ensuing scenes and ultimately ending with his death. So Jesus is arrested, and now what they do is they bring him before the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin. In verse 53, it says that they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the experts in the law, they came together. And this was at the high priest's house, which had a large courtyard, a place where they could have hearings. This was the high priest Caiaphas. And Peter had followed them at a distance all the way into the courtyard of the high priest. So it seems that the certain young man who had the garment, the linen sheet around him, who fled naked, that Peter still trailed a ways away following this crowd with Jesus. And he even now sneaks into the courtyard of the high priest's house. And he was sitting with the servants and warming himself near the light of the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were seeking testimony against Jesus in order to put him to death, but they could not find any because many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made by human hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made by human hands.'" But their testimony did not even agree on this. So this was sort of like a false trial, essentially. It was set up as a formality, but the chief priests, they were looking for a way to condemn Jesus. And so they brought in all these witnesses, quote, witnesses, who would testify in order so that they could then have a legal charge against Jesus under Jewish law. But none of the testimonies agreed. So their ploy to try to get Jesus to be condemned through external attestation by other individuals, witnesses that would testify against him, failed. So they change and they turn their tactics now to trying to get Jesus to implicate himself. Verse 60, "And the high priest stood up in the midst of them and asked Jesus, saying, 'Do you not have an answer to what these men are testifying against you?' But he remained silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest asked him and said to him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?' And now Jesus speaks and he says, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven.'" Jesus here alludes to both Psalm 110, that the Lord said to my Lord, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies footstool," and also the reference to the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven from Daniel chapter 7. And when he says this, the high priest says, "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. So after Jesus claims, "I am the Messiah, I am the Christ," he further says that he will fulfill the prophecy of Daniel 7 and the one that is referred to in Psalm 110, which is a messianic psalm. He will fulfill those scriptures. That was enough. the high priest and all the chief priests and the experts in the law, they all condemn him to die. And after he says this, some people began spitting on him, and they covered his face and they beat him with their fists. And they said to him, "Prophesy." And then the temple police took him and they also beat him. This trial in the house of Caiaphas, the high priest, it shows the brutality to which the Jewish leaders would go to try to get rid of Jesus. That when their kind of fake trial fails, they then ask Jesus directly. And when he testifies to them the truth, they cannot stand it. Because to them, there's no way Jesus could be the Messiah. He cannot be the one that they were hoping for. Primarily because everything Jesus was trying to teach and show people was counteracting what they were trying to do in controlling people and trying to get people to buy into the system of power and the institutions that had been developed around the temple and around the traditions of the elders and all these things that were not leading people into God's kingdom, but were actually making it difficult and preventing them from being able to enter into God's kingdom. It's interesting that when Jesus is asked to respond to the false accusations, he says nothing. He has nothing to say in response to these false allegations that have been brought against him. And I think this is probably fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah 53, where it says that he was oppressed. This is referring to the suffering servant. He was oppressed, yet he suffered willingly. He did not open his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter and as a sheep that is before its shears is mute, so he did not open his mouth. Now, Mark doesn't point to that prophecy, but part of when Jesus talks about the scriptures being fulfilled, I think this is in his mind, as well as in any Jewish reader of the first century, and probably certainly Mark's mind as well. But Mark doesn't make a point to draw attention to that. But the council's verdict here is driven by Jesus's offense at being the Messiah. Has nothing to do with him disobeying any laws necessarily of the old covenant or any type of legal injustice. Like he hasn't broken a law of Jerusalem or anything like that. It has to do with religious power, religious prerogative, where he was claiming to be superior to Moses even, and superior over all the Sanhedrin, over all the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the entire temple itself. He was threatening the very establishment and way of life as they knew it, and they couldn't take it. And so what do you do with somebody like that? You get rid of them. Here, Jesus is affirming his messianic identity in the face of deadly opposition. And here, as the chief priests and others are mocking him and spitting on him and beating him, this mockery and abuse is setting up the intensification in the ensuing scene when he gets handed over to Pontius Pilate. But before we get to that point in the story, we focus now on Peter. Mark draws attention to Peter, who is sitting in the high priest's courtyard next to a fire. Verse 66, as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came near. And when she noticed Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You look familiar." She says, "You were also with the Nazarene, Jesus." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you're talking about. Lady, you got me wrong. I'm not the guy." So he leaves. Peter leaves. He says, Peter goes out to the gateway to the courtyard, and the rooster crowed. This is the first time. And when the servant girl noticed him again, she began to say to those standing nearby, "This man is one of them." But he denied it again. This would be number two. And after a little while, those who were standing nearby said to Peter again, "Truly, you are one of them, because you are also a Galilean." So the servant girl recognizes Peter visually and says that he is one of Jesus's followers. Peter denies it. She says it again to some other people standing nearby, expanding the social circle of recognition here. And he denies it a second time. And now there's people who are standing nearby, even beyond that, who are saying to Peter, because they hear him talking, they know he's speaking as a Galilean because of his accent. And so they say that he is one of them. But verse 71, Peter now responds differently. He began to pronounce a curse upon himself and to swear with an oath. This is what he said. I do not know this man you are talking about. And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered the words, how Jesus said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and began to cry. This scene here, focusing on Peter, Jesus predicted that Peter was going to deny him. At the end of the Lord's Supper, when Jesus says that he's going to basically be struck down, meaning he's going to die and the sheep will be scattered, but he says that he will be raised from the dead. But Peter said to him, if everyone deserts you, Lord, I won't. But Jesus told Peter that he would deny him three times before the rooster crows twice. And this is back in verse 30 and 31, just before the scene where we get to the Garden of Gethsemane. So Peter's progression here, he's curious in what's going to happen to Jesus, and he's tagging along. But this turns into sort of like a terrible scenario for him as he is being indicted with Jesus, because anybody who is associated with Jesus would also probably be arrested and would be subject to penalty like Jesus. And this whole scene really kind of shows the contrast between Peter's bravado in being so confident that he would never do this one thing to the fact that he does exactly that. That his failure is complete. He denies Jesus three times. Not just once, not just twice, but three times. And on the third time, he doesn't just deny Jesus. He goes so far as to pronounce a curse upon himself and to swear an oath. These are two of the most sincere things you could do under the old covenant to testify to the truthfulness of something, because you were never supposed to take an oath or to swear things. But if people did swear things, then that was the most serious matter that you could possibly get yourself into. And to pronounce a curse was something that you would basically do when you were condemning somebody. So right here, Peter's saying, if I know the guy, let myself be condemned. And he's meaning it in like a kind of like a spiritual sense, being condemned before God as being guilty, which is the irony here is that's exactly what he was. He was lying directly. But Peter just does not admit association with Jesus due to his fear, due to seeing all the hype and all the commotion, seeing Jesus beaten and spit on, seeing him condemned to die. Whatever the impetus was for Peter, it was powerful, and he succumbed to it. After it happened, Peter recognizes immediately what he had done, and it breaks him. It breaks him to the core, and he begins to cry. Now Mark moves away from that scene with Peter and moves back to what happens with Jesus and continues on with the series of trials. Now it says, and immediately, so the next sequence here with immediately again, early in the morning after making a plan, the chief priests and the elders and experts in the law and the whole Sanhedrin bound Jesus and led him away and handed him over to Pilate. So they condemn him to death, but they don't want to do it themselves. So that's why here they're making a plan. They're trying to figure out, how can we get rid of Jesus in a way that we aren't then culpable before the people so that it won't backfire on us. Their plan is to have the Romans kill Jesus. So they bring Jesus before the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. So Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered and said to him, "Yes, it's as you say." And the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate asked him again, saying, "Are you not going to answer at all? Look at how many things they are accusing you of." But Jesus gave no further answer. So Pilate was amazed. There are a lot of things in the Gospel of Mark where people are amazed by miracles that Jesus did, Jesus' teaching. But here, Pilate is amazed at Jesus' silence. That under all of this pressure, in these dire circumstances where Jesus' life is in Pilate's hand, and Pilate's like, "Are you not going to give any response to what these people are accusing you of?" And Jesus didn't comply. Jesus did not bend to that request. Now, Pilate asked him about being the king of the Jews, and Jesus was very willing to affirm, "Indeed, this is true." But that's all Jesus was going to give him. Now, at the Passover feast, as it continues here, it was a custom that he release one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was a man called Barabbas who had been imprisoned with the rebels, who had committed murder under the rebellion. And the crowd went up to Pilate and began to ask him to release someone for them, as he usually did. And Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that they would release Barabbas to them instead. And Pilate continued to ask, saying to them, "Then what do you want me to do with the one you call the king of the Jews?" And they shouted out again, "Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted even louder, "Crucify him!" And Pilate, wanting to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas to them. And after having Jesus flogged, he handed him over to be crucified. This release of this one called Barabbas, who was truly a criminal, the irony here is that there's this reversal of justice happening where the innocent party is condemned while the guilty party is set free. And what this scene really does depict is the cowardice of Pontius Pilate and the Jewish leaders, but also the fickle nature of the public opinion in the eyes of the government, and the way that there is the cost of the cowardly leadership, where instead of standing up to the crowd and having Jesus released and given back to the Jewish Sanhedrin and let them deal with Jesus, Pilate gets pressured into complying with their desires. And so not only does he release Barabbas to them, but then he asks, what should he do with Jesus? Where he probably should have just put Jesus in prison or something, but they wanted Jesus to die. And they kept yelling and calling for it. And so Pilate caves and he gives in. And he flogs Jesus sort of as a way to sort of appease the crowd, perhaps in the interim, as a compromise maybe. But then ultimately he sends Jesus away to be crucified. So now the soldiers beat and mock Jesus here. They led him away. They're inside the governor's palace where the governor's headquarters is, where Pontius Pilate is. And they called together the whole cohort of Roman soldiers. And they clothed them in a purple robe, which is sort of mimicking royalty, the purple color of royalty. And they twist together a crown of thorns. They put it on his head. They began to greet him. They say, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they kept striking his head with a reed and spitting on him. And kneeling down, they paid homage to him in a false mockery sort of way. And after they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him and they put his own clothes back on him. This purple robe and crown of thorns kind of symbolizes their twisted view of his kingship. And their mockery fulfills other prophecies of Isaiah, such as in Isaiah chapter 50, and also highlights Rome's brutal contempt and violent antagonism toward Jesus. But Jesus endures all of this. And while focusing here on all the suffering that Jesus is going through, Mark makes a point here that Jesus has said nothing. He has just affirmed to Pilate that he was the King of the Jews. Throughout the rest of this narrative, Jesus is silent, enduring all of this suffering, all this pain, this humiliation without protest. This is fulfilling the prophecy that he did not open his mouth and was led to the slaughter without putting up any sort of a fight, without resisting. He is embracing his destiny as the Messiah. And to fulfill all the messianic requirements of the Old Testament in order to fulfill God's plan and purpose for him, in order to achieve redemption, salvation, and ultimately to bring to fulfillment all the promises in the kingdom of God. We will be looking at the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus in the final session coming up next.